Our first presenter this afternoon is Larry Kirkpatrick. He is the pastor of the Mentone Adventist Church in Southern California. Prior to his tenure at Mentone, he pastored churches in Nevada and Utah. He's a graduate of the MDiv program at the Seventh-day Adventist Theological Seminary at Andrews University. He serves as the webmaster for greatcontroversy.org and publishes books on last generation theology. Welcome, Larry.
Good afternoon. It's a great privilege, I feel, to be able to be here today and share with you. And I also think this is really neat that we've had such a good spirit at this meeting. Some of my fellow presenters, my paper's a little bit long on one end. So I'm going to be skipping around a little bit. I'll try to help you chase me through the paper. 50 years ago, the product of a few men was published in the name of the church as the book Seventh-day Adventists Answer Questions on Doctrine. It is not difficult to believe that the participants were well-intentioned. And yet it is precisely when we are most in earnest, when we feel the stakes so inestimably high, that we are at risk of bending moral principle. What good motives do not always translate into good outcomes. To the Adventists, it seemed a new era was opening. It was opening, although not quite as hoped for. A quote here, with the evangelical courtship of the 1950s, the Adventist leaders started something the extent of which they did not anticipate. The traditional Adventist landscape was being radically changed. And this is what I believe, intending only good, the self-described little committee of four pursued its mission, the creation of a new volume offering what they considered to be doctrinal clarification. And I'm going to jump to footnote number four on page 302 and just point out one item here. The idea of publishing a new book was not that of the Adventists initially, and I think this is an important item. It was Martin. Martin's party insisted that the repudiation of earlier errors must appear in print in order to be taken seriously. Martin was adamant that there be some authoritative Adventist volume as proof for assertions he would publish about the updated Adventist position. And that's completely understandable, isn't it? Also, it's very convenient, it trapped the Adventist. And so they had to prepare a book now, or maybe start backing away from doing the evangelical conferences. So I think this mitigates against the theory that this thing started as a conspiracy to change our doctrines. I think that I follow more of the thesis of Elder Douglas presented the other evening, that sometimes they didn't think everything through quite so far and wound up caught in a hole or a trap, or at least maybe a situation that left them with this issue of preparing a book. So I don't think it was intentional, at least at the beginning, how it began. Just two decades later, you already heard this quote the other night from Raymond Cottrell, "Let us be certain that nothing gets into the proposed book that will take us the next 50 years to live down." And very interesting for this event to hear that quote. But anyway, two decades later, Kenneth Wood could plainly declare what had in fact come to pass. Here's what he said: "I believe that the evangelical dialogues and publication of questions on doctrine created a climate in the church favorable to criticism, suspicion, uncertainty, rumor, and a loss of confidence in leadership." And of course, if Elder Wood's thesis there is true, it's important for us to look at this. I'm moving to page 280. Many people have said that the sin is the real issue. I think William Johnson may have said it best. "The issue behind the issue is the concept of sin. Those who want to understand more clearly Jesus' human nature would get further if they stopped debating whether Jesus came in humanity's pre-fall or post-fall nature and spent time looking at what the Bible says about sin itself." I think that that is very true. Going down two paragraphs, basic thesis here: "Questions on doctrine introduced to Adventism a new doctrine of sin that taught condemnation according to birth nature, a fundamentally flawed teaching. After a period of unclarity, the denomination rejected the book's alternative hamartiology, doctrine of sin, sustaining the doctrine of sin held before the publication of QOD." That's the basic point of what I'm sharing. Go to page 281 at the top. You know, Seventh-day Adventists didn't, most of our doctrines, almost all of our doctrines are not original to us, and it's the same with the doctrine of sin. The beginnings of the Seventh-day Adventist understanding of sin are rooted in the New England religious milieu from which the church sprang forth. The 17th and 18th centuries witnessed a major clash of old Calvinism with Anabaptist, Arminian, Quaker, Socinian, and Pelagian thought. This clash resulted in a seedbed of new thought and a shaking of the old establishment, according to a thesis by Edwin Zacharyson. With regard to the history of the doctrine of original sin, Adventists came on the American scene toward the end of a protracted attack on federal theology by dissenting elements, which terminated in a drastically altered view of the doctrine. So basically, the old Calvinism was modified, and we had some of the doctrine of sin that Adventists have, they adopted. It was already there. Let's go to page 282, just past the middle. Until the appearance of questions on doctrine, then, the basic Seventh-day Adventist position on sin, it was not problematic for the nature of Christ's humanity or for issues about the atonement or what happens at the close of probation and so forth. It was not problematic for any Bible doctrine. That was from now until questions on doctrine. Go to page 283. There's a historic section here and then a doctrinal section and then a historic section. I hope you don't mind blending a little historical theology in with theology, seeing how this is a 50-year conference. But at 283, let's carry on at the top of the page. What we have here is in questions on doctrine, in the pre-publication draft, this is what it had five places where it had the words original sin in there. Now, the draft that you all have doesn't have that. But here's what it said in the pre-publication draft. Adam's sin involved the whole human race. By one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, declares the Apostle Paul. The expression by sin shows clearly that he is referring not to actual individual sins, but rather to original sin, the sinful nature that we have all inherited from Adam, and Adam all die. By that original sin, death passed upon all men. Those sentences were removed ultimately, and doesn't sound as bad when you just read it as it is there. Raymond Cottrell pointed out that this was the first he'd ever heard about original sin and Adventist doctrine when he was critiquing the manuscripts. They modified the section, but if you go to page, and I think it was 406, it's here where it says, from Adam we all have inherited, 406 to 408, you have the major section where it seems like although they took out the words original sin, the doctrine, the idea itself was retained in this way. From Adam we all have inherited a sinful nature. We all are by nature the children of wrath, Ephesians 2:3. Whether we be Jews or Gentiles, we are all under sin. There is none that seeketh after God. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. Romans 3. Consequently, all are guilty before God. Verse 19. But if men will only accept God's free gift of righteousness, then no matter how far they have drifted from God or how deeply they have become embedded in sin, they can still be justified for Christ's righteousness, if accepted, is accounted as theirs, such as the matchless grace of God. If you look at that, particularly the first portion of that statement, it is evident that the authors of Questions on Doctrine viewed man as guilty or condemned on the basis of his inherited birth nature. And we have that in the other references that were removed, but we still have that. This teaching in 1957 had never been Adventist doctrine. Sin in its most fundamental essence, the sin for which we are considered guilty, to be more precise, always before had been viewed by Adventists as an issue of free will, choice exercised in rebellion. And so this new doctrine of sin was now being portrayed to evangelicals as that doctrine adhered to by Adventists. This created a new problem, and I'm going to move, skip a few pages, go to 285. It created a problem with different Adventist teachings and doctrines, statements from 623 and 425 of Great Controversy, just to point out a couple, and in fact, others. But it created a problem for what happens after the close of probation and so forth. Before that, this hadn't been an issue. On page 285, where it begins the first whole paragraph, furthermore, the 1957 introduction of the doctrine of original sin also makes it necessary to protect the humanity of Jesus from having the same vitiated nature as all other men. If we are guilty for our birth natures, then Jesus cannot have the same birth nature. And so the doctrine of original sin centers the brotherhood between Jesus and fallen man. It denies the completeness of Jesus' humanity. And so we see the imperative reason why the authors of Questions on Doctrine felt it needful to bend Seventh-day Adventist teaching concerning the humanity of Christ. And I would just point out, yes, I'm using the phrase here, original sin. Basically, that's the conventional term we normally see. Different terms have been attempted, but this is the term that we tend to use to talk about the idea of being considered guilty from your birth nature, inherited nature, and so on. We go ahead and use that term for lack of a better term. Now, the theological section I'm going to hit only very quickly, but the two evidences that are given in Questions on Doctrine sustaining this idea are found is Ephesians 2, verse 3, and some material in Romans 3. If you look closely at Ephesians 2, verse 3, I'm in the middle of 285. Ephesians 2, verse 3 reveals nowhere in this verse or in the passage in which it occurs, nowhere there do we find Paul linking the concept of children of wrath with birth nature. Rather, numerous times the passage points to the source of wrath as being pre-conversion behavior, and you can see that in the first three verses, verse 5, verse 11, verse 12. We could look at material in Colossians and Ephesians. I'm going to skip most of this section and let you look at it on your own. On page 286, halfway through the top paragraph, Edwin Zacherson, who has a thesis in the Loins of Adam, where he addresses sin in the early years of Adventist Church, and doesn't perhaps hold the same view as I would, but he still says this about Ephesians 2:3. He says, Paul says nothing about Adam's sin here, and the term by nature does not necessarily have to mean innate. And if we study this passage closely, I agree with Zacherson that we really don't see Ephesians 2:3 as sustaining the idea of you're guilty for your birth nature. But anyway, let's move on and go over to page 287. The major point where they give this doctrine of sin is found in Romans chapter 3. And this is where we read that you would be considered guilty. Here's what it says. Well, here's what I want to do here is look at real quickly Romans 3 with you, only for a moment, I guess, because of our time. In order to grasp the basis upon which Paul offers his Tanakh references, his Old Testament references in Romans 3, verses 9 to 20, there's about seven references there, and we see Questions on Doctrine authors use the verses there to sustain their teaching about original sin, being inherited birth nature, guilt for that. We need to understand the larger argument of Paul in Romans 1 to 3. So come with me to page 288, and at the top of the page you'll see a list of six items there. In the first six, and what I'm going to say here is that before Paul gets to Romans 3:9, he has actually already made his case. He's already shown shown what he's trying to show, well, let's look at the six items here that support it. In the first three chapters of Romans, Paul repeatedly pairs Jews and non-Jews side by side. Number two, Paul emphasizes that Jews and non-Jews are condemnable for engaging in the same sins, and you see the verses there on the page. Number three, God's wrath is revealed not only against Gentiles, but against disobedient Jews, while glory, honor, and peace accrue to the obedient, again, whether Jew or Gentile. Romans 2, verse 5 to 10. Number four in the list, there is no respect of persons with God, a point that Paul makes repeatedly. Number five, the true Jew is the obedient man, the false is the disobedient man. Number six, ritualistic Torah keeping is not the source of righteousness, and some verses sustaining that. Now, before Paul gets to Romans 3:9 or 3:19, already by several lines of argument, Paul has demonstrated, he's made his case. He has demonstrated that Jew and Gentile are both condemned for wrongdoing, both granted God's approbation for rightdoing, only with the realization that for Paul, these points have all been made before 3:9. Is the reader really ready, I believe, to understand Paul's remaining statements concerning sin and guilt in chapter 3? And we're going to skip now down to the bottom of 289. You have these seven references in Romans, starting in verse 9 and 10 and going out, Romans 3 there. And why does he present these references, and what is the issue going on here? Paul is quoting from all these Old Testament references, and if you look at each reference in turn, you'll see that in their original setting, they don't seem like any of them sustain the idea of universal human guilt. And this creates a problem if you're working with Jewish people. Jewish people look at the Christian beliefs, and you know, they had Psalm 51:5 1,000 years before Christians did, before there were Christians, and they didn't get a doctrine of original sin out of that. And what's interesting is that they look at Christianity, and one of the main arguments for Judaism against Christianity is, well, Christians teach this original sin, and they get it from Paul. Well, they don't get it from Paul. I don't believe it's found in the New Testament or in the Old Testament. But when you look, they look at how we read the Bible, and they have a problem. How do we read the Bible? We look and we try to sustain in every teaching by looking at what the Bible has to say. So does the Jew. And he thinks that you should be able to read from the Old Testament and then into the New Testament, and it should all be, it makes sense, it should all fit together. And so when they see Paul using these Old Testament references, seeming to teach a universal guilt upon man or universal condemnation of man, and he's using these Psalms and things back here, none of which sustain that, it looks like Paul is misusing the Psalms. The Christian is misusing the Jewish scriptures. And so we don't have to take Christianity very seriously because, look, they're obviously misusing, they're quoting out of context and misusing the scriptures that we already have. When we understand, however, Romans, that Paul has made all of his arguments before he gets to Romans 3:9, then it all falls into place. Then we can see that Paul is basically using these verses from 3:9 on out to 3:20. He's using those just as to point out that we all have become guilty by choosing rebellion against God. He's already made his case before he gets to 3:9. And this harmonizes this issue, and it should take away this from being an issue between any person who might be interested in converting from Judaism to Christianity. Otherwise, we have a problem with Paul apparently misusing the Old Testament texts. There's two ways to solve that, of course. We can say, well, the New Testament supersedes the Old, and it just overrules, it trumps the Old. I don't think we'd want to be comfortable with that in every respect. And certainly, we don't want to say, look, we can't go either way, so I'm getting off my track. I better stay on, or I'll wind up with more time than I have. Come over to 2:90 at the second paragraph. Returning to questions on doctrine, I would just conclude this section on the doctrinal part by saying that I really believe that we have to reject the assertion that men are condemned on the basis of their birth nature rather than on the basis of their personal choices to be rebels. Paul does present humankind in Romans 1-3 as condemned. Make no mistake, he does. But because of personal choices, and never on the basis of any doctrine of original sin. He says relatively little about the mechanism by which men become guilty, but what he does say seems to point repeatedly to chosen acts of rebellion. You see a list of references there. So biblical passages offered on behalf of the questions on doctrine authors in support of their new view on sin really don't sustain it, and I think that probably the Committee of Four didn't really realize what they were doing when they added this doctrine completely into the book. But it has repercussions down to this day, and several others have already mentioned, and I see by the papers others will mention the issue of sin again before this conference is over. So this seems to be a significant issue for us. All right, let's move on. 2:91. I have a paper here that I understand was embargoed for many years by Kenneth Wood, and understand that it's not embargoed now. And in 1978, there was a meeting held, and there was 52 pages that Kenneth Wood, as the presenter, shared. He especially addressed these issues from questions on doctrine that have come up. And these 10 are so important, I'm going to risk it here and share them with you. Number one, these are his conclusions about what happened at that time, the questions on doctrine problems. Number one, there was inadequate communication with the church membership while the Martin Barnhouse dialogues were taking place with church leaders. Number two, publication of articles in the ministry that seemed to be modifying Adventist teachings on the atonement and the human nature of Christ. Number three, giving the impression that the traditional teachings on these two points had been held by only a minority, a kind of lunatic fringe or wild-eyed responsibles. That wasn't helpful. Number four, suggesting that people who held the old views on these two questions would, so far as possible, be held in check. Number five, making clear that changes would be made in our publications to bring them all into line with the new views. Number six, failing to give an adequate explanation to serious Bible students within the church as to how they could harmonize apparently conflicting statements by Ellen White on the atonement and the incarnation. Number seven, failing to state frankly to church members that the church was in transition, gradually replacing biblical theology as normative with systematic theology. Number eight, publication of questions on doctrine without bylines and with the full endorsement of the General Conference. And number nine, making no provision for discussion of theological questions that were being discussed privately. And number 10, the publication of Movement of Destiny reopening the wound, I suppose you would say. Go over to 292. And three lines down on the block quotation there. I want to now go through the major books and belief statements since Questions on Doctrine just very rapidly, and let's see what the church has decided or what the church has been publishing and presenting. Have we really sustained the doctrine of sin that was found in Questions on Doctrine? The answer is no. Here we see, if you'll follow me, at the 1980 Fundamental Beliefs, which is still current. Go down three lines, and it begins here, this section I want to read. When our first parents disobeyed God, they denied their dependence upon him and fell from their high position under God. The image of God in them was marred, and they became subject to death. Their descendants share this fallen nature and its consequences. Here it is. They are born with weaknesses and tendencies to evil. This is the, really, we don't have one of our 28 beliefs now that says the doctrine of sin, but here it is found under number seven, the doctrine, really, this is our anthropology or our doctrine of sin denominationally, and here's what it says, we are born with weaknesses and tendencies to evil. So that was what the church said in 1980. Down into the very middle of the page, notice that the church has stopped short in 1980 of declaring that our birth nature was guilty or condemned. On down to the next inset quote, I think that the people who formed these fundamental belief statements, this one in particular, may have been informed by this really interesting Ellen White quote. I saw it in Rick Rice's paper. Christ is the light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world, John 1:9. As through Christ every human being has life, so also through him every soul receives some ray of divine light. Now this is interesting, not only intellectual but spiritual power, a perception of right, a desire for goodness, what? Exists in every heart. In every heart. Very interesting line. But against these principles, there is struggling and antagonistic power. The result of being the tree of knowledge of good and evil is manifest in every man's experience. There is in his nature a bent to evil, a force which unaided he cannot resist. We need to resist that force. Christ gives us power, etc. But here is our very interesting statement, which seems very much consistent with our fundamental belief statement, number seven. And I have a high appreciation for both items. Let's go to the top of 293. The statement here that we just read, I believe, was consonant with pre-Questions on Doctrine Adventism. Pre-Questions on Doctrine. All right, let's move on to 294 at the top. We did publish a book explaining our fundamental beliefs. Finally, the 1980 beliefs were published in 1988. That's a long time, but it did come. And there was an opportunity here to explain it in a way that maybe would keep us, salvage the Questions on Doctrine viewpoint on sin, but it wasn't accomplished in that book. Notice the inset quotation, many scriptural passages, including particularly the account of the fall, this is from the Seventh-day Adventist Believe book, make it clear that sin is a moral evil, the result of a free moral agent's choosing to violate the revealed will of God. Sin here is a choice again, in the Seventh-day Adventist Believe book. So that was a major publication affecting what the church believes, and here is the explanation. Down in the very middle of the page, a quotation, the summation of this part of the discussion in the book says that by nature we tend toward evil, not good. And again, I think that's a good expression of what the Bible's teaching on the doctrine of sin. That's what our book says. At no point does the book suggest that condemnation or guilt adhere to us on the basis of our birth nature. The book refuses to confirm the hamartiology of Questions on Doctrine. Then we have the Handbook of Seventh-day Adventist Theology in the year 2000. Very important because, again, it is part of the Seventh-day Adventist commentary series. It carries a lot of weight for that respect. Here's the first really strong treatment of sin that has ever been published denominationally, 37 pages in official, a pretty official form. Notice the inset quotation, "Adventists do not stress the sense of original sin in the sense that personal individual moral guilt adheres to Adam's descendants because of his," that means Adam's sin. "They stress instead that his sin resulted in the condition of estrangement from God in which every human being is born. This estrangement involves an inherent tendency to commit sin." And so this tendency word keeps coming along again, and it fits real well there. "While questions on doctrine taught that man was guilty on the basis of his birth nature, the handbook is careful in the final analysis to present the result of Adam's fall as being an inherent tendency to commit sin." On the next page, another quotation, as the article sums up, "Tendency to sin or temptation to sin is not sin. Neither constitutes a revolt against God. Yielding to sin and committing the act of sin, thus transgressing the law of God, alienate us from God and make us guilty before him." So I think those, I can agree heartily with those statements in the Handbook of Denominations as it sums up, pardon me, the Handbook of Seventh-day Adventist Theology, as it sums up, it says again, guilt is resultant only when yielding, when committing the act of sin. I think there's some very good theology in the summary statements there in the Handbook of SDA Theology. Down to the bottom of page 295, again, in 2005 General Conference session, we added another belief. We came to the number of 28 instead of 27. The book was republished, Seventh-day Adventists Believe. They just took off the ellipses at the end, and you read through it again, and basically there's no change whatsoever in the teaching on the doctrine of sin in the book produced in the New Fundamental Belief list in 2005. Which moved a notch, and in the book, Seventh-day Adventists Believe, the new edition in 2006, I believe it is. So if we summarize this from the 1980s to the present, significant waymarks and thus potential intervention and clarification points offered opportunities to salvage the questions on doctrine teaching concerning the doctrine of sin, but at no point did the church confirm that. Instead, the church let that move on. Now, I'm going to skip the there's a whole section here on North American division, kind of an exception that happened in the 1990s. There were some hard things that happened there. Books were put into print. One book said that those who hold to this last generation view more or less are parasites, and these things came off of our denominational presses, sometimes by some of our key editors. Very destructive. The Issues book came out, Purple Issues book. And that said that compared church members who believed in these things to being to active cancer cells. Usually doesn't make people too happy to be compared to a cancer cell. In fact, I had looked at some of these issues, set them aside, and when the Purple Book came out, I was at Southern College in the early 1990s, and I restudied the issue from the Purple Issues book, and after I had very carefully weighed the Issues book, I landed on the side of, I guess you would say, last generation theology, which I don't think was the intention of the authors. Onward to page 298. The book Questions on Doctrine, a few quick items. It was seen to be bridging the gap of between Adventists and other Christians. But I want you to know, if you don't know already, that the dogma of original sin, it is discredited in many places. And this book, by adding this kind of a teaching, created new barriers. Whether you're talking about Judaism, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox churches, Coptic Christianity, even the Mormons here, all of these churches, Jews, reject the doctrine of original sin. And so when we published this, we created new barriers that would make it more difficult for us to reach those people. I pastored in Utah for 2 years and a portion, surrounded by people, serious people of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They don't believe in this, and fortunately, not too many of them have read Questions on Doctrine. But this was creating a problem instead of help. Onward to page 299. How many Adventists were included? The bottom portion of the page. Donald Gray Barnhouse said this, when he was under, he was being attacked for being friendly to the Adventist. When we, that is Eternity Magazine, published our conclusion, we were greeted by a storm of protests. Let it be understood that we made only one claim, that those Seventh-day Adventists who follow the Lord in the same way as their leaders who have interpreted to us the doctrinal position of their church, those are the only ones, they said, who are to be considered true members of the body of Christ. The vast majority of Adventists were never included in the 1957 rapprochement. This fact dramatically mitigates, I think, the imagined benefit of the whole adventure. Adventists read this and they said, well, but that's not us. Some at least did. Page 300. The middle paragraph, it is imperative. On the pastoral side, I speak from a pastoral perspective. I believe it is imperative that theological decisions of questions on doctrine magnitude not be made in secret. Church members and pastors of churches, both large and small, need to be included, not kept in a blackout. It is the conviction of this author that had pastors been included in the preparation of the 1957 book, not only would its theology have been more Adventist, but that the added heart for pastoral concerns could have helped the church avoid the tangled legacy of inevitably accruing to a theology-bending book prepared in secrecy. I think that's the case. That's my conviction. To summarize, the history of the doctrine of sin in the Adventist Church shows a steady line, interrupted only by the aberration introduced in 1957. The proofs then given in support of the new hamartiology, certain interpretations of Ephesians 2, verse 3, and from Romans 3, 9 to 19, were superficial and, I believe, erroneous. Since the dissipation of the fallout from that period, the most official statements and publications of the church show a clear discontinuity with the teaching introduced by questions on doctrine. The significance of this for the remaining elements of the theological system then introduced should not be understated. Without the doctrine of sin as the foundation, the rest of the program of questions on doctrine, in particular the controverted issues we've been discussing, I believe the rest of that program is doomed. Without the doctrine of sin to support the different view on the nature of Christ and so on, all that is going to fall away. Down four lines, the questions on doctrine adventure, in spite of good intentions, I believe has proven itself to be a debacle. The secretiveness, lack of transparency, talking to non-Adventists before talking to Adventists, the heavy-handedness of the questions on doctrine era wounded the church. In particular, this is a problem for which the leadership of the church is responsible, not the laity. And some leaders in certain divisions repeated key aspects of this behavior in the 1990s. So it is the leadership of the church today that has a work to do in order to reestablish the spirit of integrity and collegiality which can and should exist. And I would say that we see the wreckage now 50 years later. Well, onward to page 301. Start at the third whole paragraph. The rejection of questions on doctrine's modification of the single most significant theological element, the doctrine of sin, in the core of the Adventist system foretells inevitable abandonment, also viewpoints falling upon the same axis. I guess I already mentioned this. The nature of Christ, the insistence that the atonement was finished at the cross with only the application of benefits following. If Froom and his associates, at the height of their denominational influence, in an era when the church was perhaps more malleable by administrative initiative than at any other time, by the introduction of their errors, were unable to evoke enduring changes in core theological essence, what then is the likelihood of accomplishing such changes in today's era? I don't think there's any likelihood of it. The core beliefs of the church cannot and should not be changed without the body first developing that openness and consensus which were never attained and were never seriously attempted in 1957. And that's why we're all still here, isn't it? We're here 50 years later looking at this question. The bottom of page 301, in the 1980, the new statement of fundamental beliefs made clear that the larger church had never made questions on doctrine's hamartiology its own. Today, the windy doctrine of sin behind questions on doctrine has all but blown itself out. But if that doctrine has been rejected, what imprint is left behind? The stink of secrecy, revisionism, heavy-handedness, and untruthfulness. The leadership of the denomination broke faith with its members and did not correctly represent its faith to outsiders. It did not hold Froom, Anderson, Reed, or Figure accountable. And what has changed? Too often, some in leadership today are permitted to press home their own agendas, heedless of the will of the world church. And I can think of one big issue, women's ordination, and there's other issues perhaps as well. Sometimes we just go our own way, regardless of what the church has said. This is the accepted practice, this is the legacy, and I believe, unfortunately, this is part of the imprint of questions on doctrine. Unless there is a change in what happens, this kind of behavior is going to repeat. And we may find it generating church crises, and we may have some other 50-year conferences coming along the way. I would close with this thought. That's the bad news. I'm sorry there was so much of it. The good news is that the Seventh-day Adventist Church has today returned to embrace the theological consensus on the doctrine of sin that existed before the publication of the most divisive book in Seventh-day Adventist history. Thank you.